Right. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Let us begin the rapporteur session. My name is Alan Whiteside. I'm the director of the Health Economics and HIV/AIDS Research Division at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. And I am a member of the Governing Council of the International AIDS Society. I'm a proud South African, which is relevant because those of you who saw the World Cup know that every game started on time, as will this session. During the conference, teams of rapporteurs have been scurrying around, collecting information which has been sifted and distilled and will now be presented to the conference by the lead rapporteurs. Our first rapporteur from Track A is Dr. Poli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I wish to thank you, the International AIDS Society, for the honor to celebrate my 25 years of commitment to HIV/AIDS research by delivering this speech at this very important conference that will be remembered as the Capriza AIDS Conference. I will not discuss microbicide, that will be addressed later in Track C, but let's remember that about 10 years ago, we were discussing the results of an anoxinonine trial, and we were wondering whether there was going to be a future for microbicide research. So I will briefly focus on three areas that caught my interest in particular. Let's start with the HIV life cycle, which is the roadmap for any anti-HIV drug discovery. We'll discuss new findings in the field of LTMP and elite controllers, that are a key natural model for vaccine development. I will finish the scientific part on the hardest target today for basic scientists as well as for clinical scientists, which is the issue of HIV persistence and how we can take care of getting rid of latent infected cells and reservoir. And I will finish with some very brief remark. So let's start with the HIV life cycle, because every important findings in the HIV field, being basic or clinical, essentially has to deal with all the steps that characterize the virus. And indeed, if you go through what has been incredible achievements in these years and decades, now we have a panoply of very potent antiretroviral drugs that target key enzyme in the virus life cycle, but also, remember, the Copernican revolution of finding CCR5 and perhaps CXCR4 entry inhibitors that target the host rather than the virus. So in this context, at least two important words needs to be mentioned, that new CCR5 antagonists such as TBR652 have been developed and tested in early trial, and TBR652 has the feature of adding to CCR5 antagonists that of another chemokine receptor, which is CCR2, which is rarely used by the virus, but it's very effective in driving and recruiting new inflammatory cells that will serve as an amplification circuit for HIV replication. And an excellent work from Belgium presented here at the conference led to the discovery of legends, which are a novel class of integrase inhibitors that will work, has the potential to work also on the viruses that already carry resistance mutation to raltegravir and integrase mutation. And a very interesting feature about legends is the fact that they work on a molecule which is called P75-LEG-GF that essentially tether the so-called pre-integration complex to the host DNA, essentially in teaching to the integrase where to cut and paste the proviral DNA. Let me move to the second topic of my brief talk, which is LTMP and elite controllers. And rewarding what Sarah Rowland-Jones elegantly explained, these are relatively rare models. Look at the bottom of the feature, where we are talking about 1%, and in the case of elite controller, even less of all infected individuals. The important thing is that these two phenotypes of natural control of HIV infection essentially have been defined in terms of immunological control, maintenance of CD4 T cells over the years, or virological control in the case of elite and viral controller. And indeed, these two phenotypes overlap, but only in part. And if you think about this, already tells you that the factors which are controlling virus replication and the CD4 T cell maintenance are only in part overlapping and probably synergistic. In a very elegant work, Benjamin Descoeur from Paris, France, essentially could demonstrate that indeed a particular subset of activated CD4 T cell, central memory cell, unlike the other subset that you can see on the left of your screen, are indeed much less infected when compared to LTMP that do not carry the so-called HLA-B allele. HLA-B allele code enlists two protective alleles, B57 and B27. And when one of these is present, within the LTMP population, the load of viral DNA in the cell is much less infected. And another study presented by Matthias Lichterfeld from Boston explore the side of the elite controllers and ask the question of why these rare individuals are so capable of maintaining low the viral load. And he basically found out that a molecule known as P21, which is an inhibitor of a cyclin-dependent kinase, that has already been independently described to contribute to the resistance of hematopoietic stem cells and macrophages to HIV infection, is the key factor that maintains elite controller CD4 T cells very ineffectively infected by the virus. And he also characterized the fact that P21 can act at the pre-integration level by blocking the reverse transcriptase step, but also on proviral DNA integrated at the transcriptional level. Let me move to an area, and I will give you just a 30-second introduction to the field of microRNA expression. MicroRNA are short RNA molecules that bind to complementary sequences in the free prime untranslated regions of target mRNAs. And usually the result of this coupling is gene silencing. It is calculated that the human genome contains at least 1,000 mRNAs that can target up to 60% of the mammalian genes. And in already another disease such as cancer, aberrant expression of mRNA has been linked to pattern of disease progression, and also exploitation in the therapy has been considered. In one study by Claudio Casoli from Milano, he explored another rare phenotype, which is the so-called multiply exposed but uninfected individuals, and compared their pattern of mRNA expression to that of long-term non-progressor and ART-naive patients. And the take-home message of this provocative and though preliminary study is the fact that there seems to be an opposite pattern of mRNA upregulation in LTMP and ART-naive versus downregulation of mRNA in multiple exposed but uninfected. Of course, this study needs to be extended and validated. We need to understand what are the targets of this mRNA, and we need to understand whether these are just marker or can be really determinants of controlling disease progression. Let me move now to the third and last general topic that I will briefly address to you today, which is the holy grail of HIV therapy. Can we achieve a real cure? I mean, in a functional or a microbiological eradication of infectious HIV from the body. And Sharon Lewin already delivered an elegant speech in the opening lecture, illustrating how essentially both activated T-cell but also resting T-cells can be infected. And therefore, strategies need to be diversified in these two categories of important cell compartment. And let's also remember that HIV reservoir are not restricted to the T-cell, but other cells in the body, such as macrophages in the tissue, central nervous system, astrocytes, dendritic cell, and probably other cell type can also contribute to the so-called viral reservoir. So, and again, this brings us back to the HIV life cycle. And I will just mention a single elegant study by Monsef Ben-Kiran and his team from Montpellier, France, that essentially went back to the major transcriptional activator that is encoded by the virus, which is the protein known as TAT, and that has the capacity to rescue a latent or stall LTR promoter by recruiting a number of factors, the most important of which is so-called PTFB, which is composed of a cyclin T1 and CDK9, and essentially asks the question, what are the complexes that associate together with these molecules? And I will just give you the end of the story, but I invite you to read either the paper to go through Monsef's elegant studies. Basically, as you can see in these little boxes, he and his team were able to individuate one after the other all the components that essentially shift a latent, inactive complex or transcription to a very active elongating PTFB complex that will lead to RNA polymerase II processive elongation and virus production. And it's self-explanatory the fact that by deciphering this important key control of HIV transcription, to lead on the one hand on the design of drugs which can maintain the virus completely shut off in the body, or vice versa, mimicry by pharmacological molecules not necessarily requiring TAT can lead to, again, the viral reactivation and the desired purging of viral reservoir. In my concluding remarks, and I'm very happy to be on time for the happiness of the chairman, I simply want to conclude by thanking the four wonderful young individuals that have helped me in these days, writing a lot of reports. You can go and access that. Let me just read from left to right. Takafira Mazuluza from Botswana, Lavina Garo from India, Patricia Monteiro from Canada, and Rien Tieninga from the Netherlands. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much indeed, Guido. And our second rapporteur for track B is Andrew Kambuga from Uganda.
Good afternoon to you all, and it's a privilege to be able to summarize what we've seen and heard in the track B of this meeting as a clinician. Track B was a very active track. As you can see, we had over 600 abstracts. And I've structured my talk to talk about new drugs and new treatment strategies because, as you're aware, the pendulum has swung in terms of when to begin treatment, driven in a large part due to the new drugs that are able to have a higher efficacy as well as greater tolerability. I'll also look at the theme that has been highlighted at this meeting concerning when to start antiretroviral therapy. We've had a number of papers addressing this important theme. I'll also talk about co-infections and comorbidities because this has been a key theme of this conference, that even in well-controlled populations, there are comorbidities that we need to think about. And of course, monitoring and pediatrics. In terms of the pipeline for clinical products that are being tested, I thought I would highlight this paper that showed the newer generation integrase inhibitors showing very good robustness within 16 weeks for a naive population. As I said, the pendulum for treatment has swung from early treatment to delayed treatment and is swinging back to earlier treatment. And products that have a higher efficacy with less tolerability are becoming important. And this paper demonstrates hope within the integrase class that there might be products that might enable us to push the treatment earlier. We've also seen papers around switching and simplification of treatment. In the progress study that was highlighted in this meeting, there was a report, as shown on the slide, of the non-inferiority of a combination of lopinavir, ritonavir, and retegravir. I think this study was important because it combined a nuke-sparing approach together with a simplification strategy where two drugs instead of three drugs were used. And of course, these are tentative findings, but they provide hope that perhaps we can simplify the treatments of people who are living with HIV. This field of clinical science is also interesting because initially we heard from the switch-match studies, which seemed to suggest that raltegravir, in terms of replacing PIs with retegravir, was not a good strategy. And in the Spiro study that was reported this week, there was an analysis that seemed to suggest that indeed we could use raltegravir as a switch strategy, which again opens up the debate around this subject. controversy about the use of treatment simplification, again within this class of atazanavir and raltegravir. This was a study that actually had to be stopped despite showing very early efficacy, as you can see in the circle. Again, showing that clinical science is dominated by a pendulum which has got to look at conflicting results that need to be weighed one against the other. And again, on the subject of when to start ART, we had data from the Cascade collaboration suggesting that perhaps there might be benefit in starting antiretroviral therapy among patients in the CD4 bracket 300 to 499. This same analysis seemed to suggest that there was limited benefit among subjects with a higher CD4 count. And this again brings up the debate of when to start antiretroviral therapy. I think an increasingly recognized dimension concerning when to start is the analysis around cost effectiveness. And at this meeting, analysis from the SHA study was presented from a pediatric population suggesting that starting early is a cost-effective strategy, as you can see in the circled areas. To note that most of the costs are actually driven by inpatient costs when patient initiation is deferred. So I think it's going to become increasingly important to look at cost-effective analysis when we are talking about when to start treatment. And of course, one of the highlights of the when to start treatment debates, which also creates a good bridge into the discussion on co-infections, was the Camellia study that suggested that there is benefit in starting treatment, antiretroviral treatment, early among patients who have tuberculosis. It was also nice to note in this study that even though there were many immune reconstitution events in the early arm, this does not translate into mortality, which helps clinicians to feel safe. There was a study that highlighted the need for us to roll out isoniazid prophylaxis among patients with TB. And I think one of the take-home messages, particularly for clinicians in resource-limited settings, is the immediate initiation of IPT in this very significant population. In terms of other co-infections, we did see a study that suggested that fracture rates are higher in patients with hepatitis B, as well as an analysis, a retrospective analysis of a cancer registry suggesting that incidence of cancer, even among suppressed patients on treatment, seem to be much higher than the general population. And this highlights the theme of beyond ART, that in suppressed individuals, we need to think about other comorbidities and probably include screening regimes. This is another study talking about bone loss, one of the comorbidities that are important. In terms of monitoring, as you know, in resource-limited settings where viral load monitoring is not routinely done, there was an analysis that showed that there are benefits in terms of remaining on first line, in terms of death and loss to follow-up. And so I think we need to continue putting pressure on the availability of viral load monitoring in resource-limited settings. Not to forget pediatrics. There was a study that suggested that we can use PIs and they compare very well with non-nucleoside-based drugs in terms of achieving good virologic suppression. This is important in terms of the relative toxicities of these two classes of drugs. I cannot finish this track without mentioning the CAPRISA study, which was a proof-of-concept study, which I'm sure will be highlighted by my colleague in prevention, but provided hope for us in the clinical science section. And I think it's important for us to think about the what next after the CAPRISA study, just to highlight that there are a number of studies that are ongoing and that definitely, even though it was a breakthrough, there are many issues that need to be thought through by doing additional studies. So what were the key messages that I saw from this meeting? First of all, that we need to continue to provide clinical settings to explore the role of new drugs so that we can contribute to this debate of early versus delayed treatment. We certainly need to start earlier, as was shown in certain populations, certainly patients below 350, certainly in patients with TB, and in children, the cost-effective analysis that I just highlighted. It is less certain in those who are with less advanced immunosuppression, but clearly that we need to start treatment earlier. And as someone who comes from a resource-limited background, that we should initiate antiretroviral therapy at the earliest opportunity. And I'd like to acknowledge a team, which was a multi-continent team that led to the summary of this track. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for an excellent presentation, and it's my pleasure to invite our third rapporteur, Anne Bouvet, to talk about track C.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I will present a report on track C on behalf of this team with people from India, Tanzania, Peru, and Australia. The highlight of this conference was undoubtedly the presentation of the results of the CAPRISA 004 trial. This was a trial of a vaginal microbicide that contained an antiretroviral compound, tenofovir. The trial was conducted in South Africa in HIV-negative women, and it was a proof-of-concept trial, double-blind and placebo-controlled. Insertion of gel was coital dependent. That means that women were instructed to insert a gel within 12 hours before anticipated intercourse and within 12 hours after intercourse. This is the first trial of a vaginal microbicide that has shown a statistically significant protective effect against the acquisition of HIV infection. The protective effect was 39%, but I wish to point out to you, and I don't want to be a spoiled sport, that the lower bound was 6%, the lower bound of the 95% confidence interval. Very good news also was that the gel had a protective effect against HSV2 infection as well, a protective effect of 51%. Considering the interaction between HIV and HSV2, this is also very good news. There were no safety issues, and more importantly maybe, so far no resistance against tenofovir was detected in women who seroconverted while taking tenofovir gel. So there is a lot of excitement, but we are not yet ready to roll out. This is one trial in one population. We need confirmation and in diverse populations, and we need to develop better strategies for adherence to bring that up to a higher level. More good news came from a study conducted by UNAIDS. They analyzed HIV prevalence data among young people 15 to 24 years in 21 countries with generalized epidemics. And they found that between 2000 and 2008, there was a significant reduction in HIV prevalence in 10 countries. In 8 of these 10 countries, the reduction was parallel with a change in sexual behavior towards more safe sex. But we cannot rest on our laurels, and we still need more interventions for young people. There was a presentation on Sunday about a cash transfer program presented by the World Bank. This type of interventions have advocates, but also critics, as was highlighted in one of the sessions. Now, what was the intervention? The intervention consisted of transferring cash to households and young girls to keep them in school. After 1 year, there was a statistically significant difference in HIV and HSV2 prevalence, which was lower in the intervention group. It's uncertain whether this was due to schooling or to higher income. The situation of intravenous drug users in Eastern Europe, however, remains more grim. A survey was done in 8 cities in Russia. HIV prevalence among IDUs ranged from 2.6% to 64.3%. But in 3 cities, the prevalence was over 50%. IDUs were mostly sexually active, and a sizable proportion of them reported non-IDU sexual partners, which highlights the potential for spread in the non-IDU general population. Then few data are available from Africa so far on IDUs, but this study from Zanzibar was the first to use responder-driven sampling in sub-Saharan Africa, and they found an HIV prevalence of 16%. Needle and syringe programs, do we need to say again that they are cost-effective? Well, there is again evidence for cost-effectiveness. A very nice study from Australia that demonstrated that in the past 10 years, for every $1 invested in NSPs, there was a gain in 0.2 days of disability-adjusted life, and more than $4 were returned in healthcare cost savings. But also from Eastern Europe, there is good news. In Estonia, numbers of needles distributed increased dramatically between 2003 and 2009, and HIV incidence among new injectors appear to have decreased between 2005 and 2009. So there is strong evidence on cost-effectiveness of needle and syringe programs in different settings also, including in Iran, but policies and laws block implementation, as was highlighted in the session of the Lancet series. In the opening session, Dr. Yves Souterrain pointed out that violations of human rights are a barrier to knowing your epidemic. And here is an example from Kampala in Uganda, where a study was done employing responder-driven sampling to recruit MSM. Recruitment was hampered twice in the course of the survey because of police actions against gay activists. HIV prevalence among these men was 14%. Stigma and discrimination also block access to prevention and care services, as was highlighted by studies from South Africa and Senegal. What is also something we need to pay attention to is that many of these men have female partners, and the behaviors of these men also put their female partners at risk. And there is little awareness among health service providers about the risks behaviors of these men and their partners. Commercial sex workers, more good news from Avahan. Worldwide, the largest program targeting commercial sex workers in 6 states in India. In Karnataka, one of the states, a careful evaluation was done of the program, and it was found that longer duration of program exposure was associated with increased condom use, and alongside with that, there was a significant reduction in HIV prevalence from nearly 20% to 16.4%. So where are we with male circumcision? In 2006, there was a lot of excitement about the results of the trials. Now we need to implement this intervention. In Kenya, it was shown that rapid scale-up was feasible and safe, and task shifting does not jeopardize the safety of the procedure. But we need also to carefully monitor what is happening in the population when you start rolling out a male circumcision program. A population-based survey was done in Kisumu in western Kenya, and it was found that there had been an increase in prevalence of male circumcision and no evidence yet of sexual risk compensation. Mother-to-child transmission. Prevention of mother-to-child transmission is very efficacious, but coverage is still suboptimal, with 58% in Eastern and Southern Africa, the region with the highest rates of pediatric HIV infections. Exposure to ARVs during pregnancy could potentially lead to toxicities in mothers and babies. The antiretroviral pregnancy registry analyzed over 11,000 pregnancies and came to the conclusion that there was no indication of increase in birth defects from babies who were exposed to ARVs during pregnancy. The prevalence of birth defects was 2.7 per 100 live births, which is similar to what you would find in the general population. Treatment as prevention was hotly debated at this conference, but what do we have in terms of evidence? There is the biological plausibility, of course, that treatment lowers plasma viral load, hence lowers onward transmission. There is work that has been done with mathematical models, and the general feeling is that treatment could lead to a reduction in HIV incidence. But what do we have in terms of empirical evidence? At the individual level, we know that there are several studies from discordant couples that have shown that the risk of transmission reduces to very low levels when the HIV-infected partner is treated, but the risk is not zero. At a population level, we have heard from ecological studies from British Columbia and now recently also from Denmark that found a correlation between increase in coverage of heart and a reduction in new HIV diagnosis. However, there are some, what somebody called, inconvenient truths we have to face. What about transmission during acute infection? How much do we know about it? How frequent is it? And it's likely to be different in different populations. How can we prevent transmission of resistant strains? And last but not least, for how long can we sustain viral suppression at a population level? Then lastly, about combination prevention, UNAIDS defines combination prevention, and I'm going to take some shortcuts, as a simultaneous use of different classes of prevention activities, biomedical, behavioral, structural, to respond to specific needs of particular populations and to make efficient use of resources. There, we have heard examples of combination prevention, among them the Avahan program in India, but they are very challenging to evaluate. Randomized control trials are difficult and may not be well suited because they are complex interventions, and the future is probably for the use of a variety of methods and data sources after having made explicit the pathways towards impact. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Anne, and compliments to these remarkable teams of rapporteurs who are working and producing these. Our next rapporteur is Lorraine Scher, who is going to report on Track D.
Good afternoon. I'm going to talk on Track D, the social science side, where we talk about, in the land of Freud, what happens to human beings inside their mind when they work as individuals in society. We know from Track D that there was a 1% chance of an oral presentation, a 1% of a poster, 42% of an actual poster without a discussion, and 55% of papers were rejected. As we've come in every day, we've seen outside the U-Bahn Mozart and Strauss to greet us, to remind us that we're in Austria, but everybody knows that the real thing about Austria is the sound of music. So we're going to... We're going to use Track D as a bit of a sing-along of Sound of Music. and I'm going to rely on you to help me because I warn you, I can't sing. So, anyone can help? How do you solve a problem like prevention? Well, okay, we have some serious stuff. This lovely piece from Strathdy showed that combination prevention, which my colleague has just gone into, could potentially have quite a dramatic effect in terms of rollout. This is a nice study by Fisher, who reminded us that we not just focus on drug use, but also there's pregnant drug users. And although there's a change over time of women who are IDUs coming and being found to be positive during pregnancy or prior to pregnancy, please look at this slide, which shows that many of them are actually picked up around delivery, which is very late, and that's increasing over time, not decreasing. Anyone here? Climb every mountain. Oh, I love you. For me, the mountain was mental health. There was a session entirely devoted to mental health, which looked at depression, food insecurity among men who have sex with men, interventions, resilience, and OVC. A systematic review showed suicide is still on the agenda. And there's a cross-cutting issue. This was a slide by Wiesner, who looked at deportation. But what's the mental health associated with being deported? How do you feel? What's the stress? And are we picking this up? This was a lovely study by Lucy Kluver, who followed just under 1,000 children over 4 years. And she neatly looked at AIDS orphaned, other orphaned, very often by very violent means, a lot of murder in the sample, or road traffic accident, etc., and non-orphaned, and look at that depression, post-traumatic stress, anxiety, peer problems, and all of them higher in the AIDS orphaned. In the follow-up data, you see that the AIDS orphaned are significant. They're all the mental health gets worse over time. But look at the rate, and the rate goes very much higher for the AIDS orphaned. So we're not doing anything. We're sitting there and watching the mental health decline. And this is an interesting study by Claudine Mellons, who looked at a group who we are missing a little bit. This is the group of long-term early infected adolescents who are now surviving into adolescence. They were infected during pregnancy, and now this is their issues. But interesting is the positive and the negative. These are the exposed children who are born to positive mothers. Look, they have similar levels of problem. Family-based approach. Now, this was a very important theme that came right through the conference, treating the child in the family. Elaine Abrams showed reaching out to other adults. Teresa Bettencourt showed the complexity of providing work with families. And these were a few of my favorite things. Models preach integration. Social science must be integrated. And in fact, this feedback entrenches separation. We found it really difficult to keep to track D when we see social science creeping in anywhere, and we'd like a balance. Any of this? The Bills are alive with the sound of music. Well, we all saw Bill Gates and Bill Clinton. And guess if I were going to talk about finance? No, I'm not. I'm going to talk about aging under that one. We all get older, don't we? And this is a lovely study by Lisa Power, who really look at the figures there on one of the many main concerns of older people, loneliness, self-care, depression. We need to keep track and an eye on lonely. High on the hill? High on the hill? We thought that was drug use. Okay. What do we do about drug use? Well, we know, and this, you know, if you, one of the take-home messages was 67% of HIV cases, but only 25% of those on treatment. Real problem. And here another study by Strathdy, really looking at the inadequate art provision and sexual transmission can really play a very key role in some IDU-related epidemics. I bring you this picture, which I stole from a lovely presentation by Fisher, and this is the original paper that showed us that methadone works. It was done in 1965. Barack Obama was born on the 4th of August in 1961. He was 4 by the time this came out. I'm sure he was really exaggerated in his ability to read, so he had his entire lifetime to read this paper. Here we go. So we're pleased, and I'm thrilled to tell you that there's 12,000 had signed by yesterday. By today, the number is up to 13,000. Please sign the Vienna Declaration. That's a real proud achievement. Where's my singer? Help. I am... Thank you. Youth and children. I'll do this one quite quickly. Children, especially from very vulnerable groups, children of men who have sex with men, children of drug users, children of sex workers, where are they? Who's looking at them? There was a lot on HIV-positive children, but generally they are being left behind in treatment. We hear about access for all, but what if you're small? Maless in a study of adolescents showed low disclosure to children, only 33% actually knowing about the HIV, and it did increase as they got older, as they were given prophylaxis or ART. And in this conference, there really was a lack of focus on the uninfected, but the affected children. A lovely study by Priscilla Aquara, which actually won the prize, you must have seen us give it yesterday, which was really an evidence-based idea of how orphans... are picked up in studies across 59 countries. Orphans are not significantly worse off than non-orphans on all the three outcomes of child well-being. And actually, they looked at predictors that they would be able to use in projects to pick up. And maybe that will help us with the stigmatization of orphans. This is a sad one. So long farewell. Au revoir, Zane. Goodbye. Please, please remember this continuing increased survival has been welcomed, but... even with universal art, we cannot prevent death. All the issues, the ultimately underserved people are people who are dying. We have very few presentations on them, and we only four on pediatrics. Doe, a deer, a female deer, the feminization of the epidemic. We want elimination of vertical transmission. We see that 45% of pregnant women are getting treated, but that's only of those who are being tested. You know about lies, damn lies, and statistics. Well, if you only have 2% of voluntary counselling and tested available, that, you won't know everyone in the country, so that 45 is a very inflated figure. And women are not fully included in clinical trials. A lovely study by Asher Person on serodifference does the Swiss statement inform women, and essentially it didn't. Things like desire, intimacy, and relationships do. Ray, a drop of golden sun, as you said. What was the cutting edge to us? Well, the first one is needle exchange news finally filtered through to PEPFAR. It only took 28 years. But we are pleased. And, of course, the microbicide results, all the Kareems and the wonderful team. But there were social science implications. I want to highlight those. There were three. One was how important adherence was. Although it provided a 39% protection in the subgroup who had over 80% adherence, that went up to 54. So psychology and social science goes in there. Motivation, they use some great motivational interviewing techniques, theory-driven, and decision-making. How do you know 12 hours in advance if you're going to have sex? Well, I don't know. So, hold on, what's the time now? Me, a name, I call myself. To us, this is the positive perspective. Right here, right now, we were really enjoyed seeing the presence, participation, voice, and visibility of people with HIV at a level that's not been seen before, planning the conference content, presenting evidence, chairing sessions, and actually leading from the front. And that reminds us of what Mina said, no top-down, bottom-up. Well, you know what I mean. Far a long, long way to run. Well, where have we got to go? The MDG goals. Where will we be by 2015? And, of course, that will bring us back to Doe. The Robin Hood tax, the financial transfer. We know that this clever idea of every time money is transferred that you add a little percentage on, it's been launched in Spain. You know, the Spanish won Wimbledon. They won the World Cup. But they're doing the clicks. It's coming to America, apparently after Thanksgiving. Philippe Desplazy from Unit 8 gave a lovely discussion on that. But not only do we have innovative finance, we also have to have innovative spending. Edselweiss. how to get wise about AIDS. Well, I've listed things about, we put aside the methodological debates, we've got lots of good methodologies. We need evidence-based policy. There's a complex understanding here, and we can build on it. The structural approach, the family-based approach, these are the key new words and the new way forwards. We need integrated models, and of course, stigma. We see that there's stigma, and stigma creates risk. Lovely studies, this was one by Kurtz, that shows that if you have stigma, risk goes hand in hand. And look at the corollary of that. This is a really lovely study by Gregson, which showed that if you have commitment and if you're connected to your society, you reduce vulnerability. So not only is stigma bad, but non-stigma and community connectedness is really good for you. Criminalization, well, we've spoken a lot about the law that's been used as a spear, but what about the law that could be used as a shield for us? So we should be taking criminalization, and hopefully we should have the law on our side protecting the rights, not the opposite. So that leads me to say thank you to all the people who gave us some nice, some nice images. All those, can you put your phone down, please? I'd like to acknowledge the Von Trapp family rapporteurs, who were just wonderful. Oh. I'm not finished yet. I've got 89 seconds on this clock. So as we say goodbye to Vienna and we eat our lovely Sachertort, are sweet dreams made of this? Or do we want to look at the data instead? Thank you.
Innovative, thoughtful, fun, and for the other speakers, we'll treat applause, laughter, and singing as we treated injuries in the World Cup, and you will be allowed extra time for singing, laughter, and applause, but otherwise we stick to the time. Thank you very, very much, Lorraine. And our sixth rapporteur is Per Barker, reporting on track E.
Well, thank you. It's a very tough to follow that, but I'll give it a go. Okay, so track E, we'll talk about the role of health systems providing quality care to all who need it, how we finance the health systems that provide that care, and talk a little bit about the operations research that will study the coverage and the financing. I'm pleased to say that track E is a new track. We're very excited about it. We got over 1,000 abstracts accepted, so we already have a fan club, and I'm very grateful to those of you who came to the oral sessions and who submitted their reports. Thanks also to the IAS for forming this track and to Wafa Al-Sadr, who ably led us. I really hope that this will grow and hope to persuade you briefly that this is a very, very important topic as we try to face the future. So the current state, as we were told, is that we're not doing very well. We're under 50% performance in low and middle income countries for both heart and for antiretrovirals to mothers. This leaves us with a gap of people who are dying, who are not getting treatment, and a gap of infants who are getting infected unnecessarily. This problem is all over the world. It's not just low- and middle-income countries. Some of the worst-performing countries are in Eastern Europe and North Africa and Middle East. You can see every single one of these countries has a significant gap in the terms of coverage. More importantly, there is no one single health system's response to this problem. Every one of these countries has a different type of epidemic. There are low-burden countries and high-burden countries and high-prevalence countries, low-prevalence countries, and you have mixtures. Each one of them will need a separate response. It's not just numbers. It's the quality of care that we have to be particularly concerned about. There were a number of sessions, really good sessions, looking at strategies to try to keep people in care who've been started on treatment. This is not easy. Speaker after speaker showed us very small successes in getting people back into care. And the obvious conclusion from these sessions is we have to design systems that prevent people from falling off care rather than to spend tremendous amount of effort chasing around after them after they've fallen out of care. And then there's finance. There was a lot of concern expressed about the potential for levels of funding flattening off, and it's a reality. Both commitments and disbursements have flattened, and there's no predictability, no prediction of where that's going to go. Is finance levels going to be sustained at their current level of acceleration? Are they going to flatten, or are they going to decrease? Meanwhile, we've got a problem. We've got an epidemic on our hands, and we still want to maintain this trajectory. What we do know is that the assumptions that we have relied on for this rapid increase in the number of people who are accessing heart do not apply anymore, and it forces us to think of different ways of looking at the health systems that support ARV programs. We've heard impassioned pleas, which we all support, to lobby to replenish global funds, but we'll make our case much easier if we can make the case for cost effectiveness and return on investment. And that study that we have to do, and some of the really exciting work that's been done that was presented at this conference, addresses that issue. We were told about innovative, and the last speaker referred to these tax systems that may bring us additional external funding, but we should not rely on it. There were also some really interesting comments that were made about the responsibilities of the countries where these epidemics are happening to really face up to the obligations, particularly those under the Doha Declaration, where local health systems should be putting at least 15% of their GDP into health systems. This is not happening, and it's certainly one way in which funds need to be accessed. So on the other side, can we do things better with less? And we do need operational research on costing of methodologies. I'll tell you about a couple of interesting cost-benefit analyses. We've got to continue to fight to reduce costs of drugs, and I'll show you examples of that. Cost-benefits of the new WHO guidelines. It's clear that the WHO guidelines are going to bring benefits. And most importantly, there is much that we can do to become more efficient and to ensure that we can, in fact, continue to scale up antiretroviral therapy globally. This report from Laurie Bollinger showed the effect, the financial implications of the 2009 WHO recommendations. The depressing part of it, obviously, is that there will be a tripling of costs between now and 2010 and 2015 just to maintain coverage or to increase coverage. The cost per person is $800 per year, but she contrasted that with the cost per death averted, which is about $10,000. There is a gap here, and one of the speakers referred to the gap between the time that it takes to get your return on investment. But we do have to make a strong case that there is a very strong return on investment, even though it may be delayed a decade or so. There was a very interesting study on potential cost savings from implementing different types of recommendation particularly for pediatrics. The WHO recommendations for A or B. First of all, the calculation in 15 of these PFR countries that it would triple the number of infections that would be averted. There was also an interesting observation that option A is a lot cheaper than option B for those countries that in fact are considering option B. I think also the new recommendations are highly cost effective. Every single one of the examples that they looked at, the ICER, the cost-benefit ratio, was less than the GDP per person, which means by definition that they are all very cost-effective. And in fact, you can see in some of these countries in green here, South Africa, Kenya, Botswana, etc., there were actual cost savings apart from just simple cost-effectiveness. The problem is that the opportunities are limited in terms of health systems efficiencies for saving money. If you look here, the primary cost coming down the pike, if we again implement these new guidelines, is going to be drugs and labs, so leaving us not much opportunity here for service delivery and for testing improvements. But there is encouragement from the Brazil experience, which showed not only, as we know, massive decreases in the cost of drugs due to negotiations, but an additional 74% here of savings was gathered due to mandatory license, local production, and also collaboration with Russia and Thailand over licensing. So the health system, the cost-effectiveness of interventions should also be taken into account. Here's an example of the incremental cost-effectiveness for facility-based versus versus an outreach campaign for testing, going around to different clinics, sending teams around versus campaigns in Uganda, and it showed, in fact, that there was a significant advantage to the outreach campaigns over both campaigns and waiting for people to come and test at your facility. In Rwanda, there was a comparison of community-based health insurance performance versus performance-based financing, which has got a lot of attention. And in fact, it was shown that there was a very significant improvement in HIV delivery with the community-based health insurance, but this was not shown for performance-based financing. So I think there's a lot to be learnt, and there are a lot of assumptions about the way that health systems are configured that need to be challenged by these kinds of studies. Here's another very interesting approach to HIV counseling and testing. This is a campaign that was combined with malaria and diarrhea protection campaign in Kenya. They got to 51,000 people over 7 days, reaching 80% of the targeted population, and again showed a cost of effectiveness in terms of the averted costs, and were able to target two other very important diseases, showing an integrated approach, which I think we could learn a lot from. So there's another big problem that we were tackling in our track, which is really how do we get from what we're really good at, which is developing great ideas and developing them in basic science, taking them to proof of concept, developing large randomized controlled trials, which we get published rather easily, and then we hit the block, which is really how do we get these very important evidence-based interventions into the real world, into resource-constrained settings, into a real-life environment where you really don't have study coordinators running around and you don't have the ability to keep a close track as you do in your trials. And certainly one thing we really do badly is scale-up. So how do we design an intervention that starts with scale-up in mind? And I think that, you know, we've seen a lot of excitement at this conference about the effectiveness of existing drugs and particularly new drugs coming on stream. We've also seen a lot of models for both prevention and for treatment, but I would argue that all of these assumptions, all of these models, all of these evidence-based treatments are held hostage to the effectiveness of the systems in which they are implemented. And if we are unable to implement these or improve these health systems, we will not deliver these drugs. Rather sobering news from an analysis of a real-life scenario, PEPFAR-supported programs, and some of these are fairly well-resourced programs in PEPFAR-supported countries. If we look at the levels of testing and counseling for 2008-2009 and levels of antiretroviral prophylaxis, you'll see a big range from those performing very well, South Africa, Botswana, Zambia, etc., down to those who are performing very poorly. I'd also draw your attention to the two lines on this graph. These represent PEPFAR targets, which are both set at about 80%. So 80% performance, which is where PEPFAR is wanting these programs to go to. And there was a very important presentation by Caroline Ryan, which asked the question, is really, are we setting the right performance goals for these programs? And they did some modeling, and they suggest that if PEPFAR did meet its goals, which is the 80% performance of the system, the maternal mother-to-child transmission rate would, in fact, be 15%, not 2%, which is what the drug delivery system is designed to produce. That if they improved that 85% coverage, the rate would only drop to 10%. And in order to get down below 5%, which is the so-called virtual elimination of a mother-to-child transmission, you would need a 96% coverage goal. The biggest problem is attrition. This is a paper that was quoted often from Jeff Stringer, which shows how hard it is to run a health system that has a sequential drop-off of patients. Even when you think you're doing really well with a 90% performance, you can end up with only 50% of the mothers getting the drugs. So the good news is quality improvement is gaining strength as a methodology for improving health systems, with a number of abstracts and organizations who are contributing. I want to give you just one example of a really low-tech solution which I think holds the key to how we can get locally driven, locally inspired ideas to solve local problems. This is a set of clinics in Swaziland where they had a problem of low CD4 counts and a long turnaround time. Some enterprising clinic managers decided to start using public transport to carry the samples to the lab and to get the results back. The results were very, very good. He got from a baseline of 22 samples per site to 293, all in a matter of 6 weeks. And the turnaround time dropped from 6 weeks, 2 weeks to 5 days. Just in terms of utilizing the resources we have a lot of NGOs in these countries, and we have a lot of knowledge and resources, but it's very uncoordinated. This is a great example presented by a colleague of mine, Kid Almate, who were asked by the national government of South Africa to help coordinate NGOs working in districts. These are NGOs already working in these districts. They all worked off a similar quality improvement design, assisting district offices to assist their clinics. The leverage of this kind of approach is tremendous. You can get to hundreds of clinics using this, so long as you can coordinate everybody to work off workable strategies. The results were dramatic. You can see the performance here is over 95% for just about all of the cascade of PMPCT. This is 151 clinics in 9 districts over a period of 9 months. Even our holy grail, which is getting mothers who are on antiretrovirals onto heart, was achieved from a start rate of 22% to up to 55% over a 9-month period. And this is 151 clinics all able to achieve this mean improvement through application of a coordinated assistance from a number of NGOs. One of the other ways of closing these gaps is by using some modern technology. In particular, point-of-care testing is very promising as a way to close these gaps. HIV testing, CD4 count, viral load, and TB all show promise. And what you can do is you could take all of these steps and you can collapse them into one. Mother can come in and start treatment immediately, and you immediately lose all that drop-off. Finally, we had a very inspiring talk from Elaine Abrams, who spoke about integrated care. It's the obvious way we have to go. All the maternal and child HIV services need to fall under the MCH umbrella and deliver care. If you cannot get mothers to antenatal care, the statistic is 55% of mothers only will attend 4 times antenatal care, and half mothers deliver at home, you will not deliver PMTCT. So if you don't solve that problem, you will not solve PMTCT. MSF has been at the frontier of showing us how to integrate care into general services and to TB services. And in summary, these I think were my take-homes from the conference. We need to use existing knowledge and new knowledge to close the remaining gaps for prevention and care. We need to modify our health system's response in view of the global financial changes. Pay a closer attention to cost effectiveness and return on investment to make the argument to the funders and to show us the way. We need to design prevention and treatment strategies for real-life health systems, not just our clinical trials. And we need to learn how to scale them up and to publish this. There needs to be better NGO-to-NGO and funder-to-funder collaboration to capacitate national health systems to deliver sustainable, cost-effective, high-quality HIV care that can be rapidly scaled. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. How encouraging to see local solutions, and how nice to see Swaziland up there. Ngiyabonga kakhulu. Thank you from Swaziland. Our next presenter is for Track F is Damon Barrett. Thank you, Damon.
Thank you. Okay, I'd like to start this time by thanking my team. In particular, Rebecca Schleifer from Human Rights Watch, who's helped me when I first was asked to do this and panicked. I'm going to start with the stats, but I'm going to skip over it. I'm just going to say that, of course, we didn't get to everything. It's the usual rapporteur's proviso. And I would like to congratulate IAS for the incorporation of human rights into many tracks, as I think we saw in B and C. So Susan Timberlake's mantra for the week sums up my talk. We can't continue to talk about human rights abuses and stigma and discrimination without, in the next breath, saying what to do about it and demanding that funding goes to community rights-based solutions. So we heard a lot about the problems we face this week, and I will repeat them. But we also heard what people are doing. I think that's really important, and I'm going to try and bring those solutions in. It's a really difficult track, so I've used this basic circles of influence diagram, both as a reminder of the complexity of the epidemic and the laws and policies that surround it, but also to locate the many concrete actions people are taking. We have two international legal systems that have a massive impact on access to medicines, and neither of them works. TRIPS, the International Drug Control System, they're both complex. They're both of moving targets, and they're evolving. The threats are evolving. Both have international, national, and community dimensions. India's Patent Act showed how national legislation can, within international flexibilities, can have impact on another continent, in this case, Africa. But then in Africa, national laws are damaging that progress. This week we heard from those engaged in international lobbying, national law reform campaigning and training of patent officers, a multi-pronged strategy responding to these challenges. But others remain. Anti-counterfeiting laws and free trade agreements pose further barriers. Similarly, we heard from those working on access to opiates for pain relief and drug dependence treatment. Flexibilities within the drug treaties are being exploited. Model national laws are being drafted and doctors are being trained on opiate prescription. But the stigma surrounding these medicines is significant and must be addressed too. If human rights enshrined in international law are to count, they must be translated into national law and policy, and they must be realised on the street. Criminalisation blocks all of this. This is why legal aid, legal empowerment and legal literacy for criminalised groups is so important. This includes the use of affidavits to transform that which may be seen as hearsay into something admissible in court. In the UK with African migrants, in Botswana to challenge sodomy laws, and in Namibia to challenge sterilisation of women living with HIV, this strategy is being utilised. Legal aid programmes for drug users in Ukraine and Indonesia, and for sex workers in Cambodia show that legal aid is not just about provision of a service, but about community empowerment. It's also about law reform from the grassroots. A human rights and sexual rights framework, not criminalisation, is the answer. We heard from Portugal about its successes in decriminalising drug use and possession, and New Zealand's decriminalisation of sex work. However, laws can be drafted and policies perfected, but this is not enough. Social attitudes must also change. A fascinating study on construction workers in China showed that this can happen, but it takes dialogue and it takes information. I should make clear, by the way, that administrative measures can be as bad or even worse. Drug user registry in Eastern Europe and drug detention centres in East Asia are both ostensibly administrative sanctions. Something that was not as much of a focus on the official programme was the broader human rights picture, the day-to-day lives of people living with and affected by HIV. Public hearings for over 100 children affected by AIDS in India showed that their main problem was not the virus, it was lack of food. I raise this to tell you that the hearings themselves resulted in action being taken to address food security for those children and other issues. Another study presented here showed that education has positive impacts on reducing HIV transmission, both among girls and boys. The impact of education and income, indeed, is a query in the Caprisa trial, as we just heard. I must confess that the quote on this slide doesn't come from the conference. It was emailed to me by a friend before I came here. He was talking about drug users dying of exposure in Afghanistan before getting anywhere near a harm reduction service. I've talked a bit about empowerment, but let me reiterate that accountability and empowerment are connected. We all know this. The importance of the greater meaningful involvement of people living with HIV and the need for investment in this is clear. I don't need to tell you that. But what I'd like to ask is, how do we involve criminalized groups? How do we involve youth? What mechanisms can we put in place to facilitate mothers living with HIV to fight for their own rights? This was somewhat of a gap in the official program. Anya Sarang started the week with a literary theme. I'm going to add my own, although it's from a comic book. Who watches the watchmen? This week we heard a lot about donor accountability. UNICEF's funding of what can only be described as a center of child abuse in Cambodia. UNODC's complicity in executions for drug offenses. And we heard that human rights advocacy works. One of those Cambodian centers is now closed because of Human Rights Watch's actions. Corruption on ARV procurement is being fought, with advocates in the Ukraine forcing a government investigation. These are important wins. The collusion of healthcare staff in human rights abuses, from blackmail to denial of care for certain groups, needs even greater focus. Again, the importance of legal empowerment cannot be understated. Perhaps by Washington we'll hear of a conviction of such abuse. This is the sharp end of accountability, human rights enforcement. I'd also like to see more discussion of business and human rights. Know your epidemic, apply a rights-based approach. That's our mantra. But what we've heard this week is that knowing the epidemic, which is not just biological in character, requires a rights-based analysis. Human rights has sometimes been seen as a barrier to public health goals. But now, the predictions of human rights advocates are coming to pass. Provider-initiated testing and counselling serves as an example. Women in South Africa have reported denial of immunisation for their children because they refuse testing. Women in Serbia who are pregnant feel enormous pressure to be tested and are vilified if they don't want it. They might have very good reasons for that. The model for treatment as prevention is impressive, and it's not my area. It's the first time I've seen it. But my first thought as a human rights-leaning kind of guy was, how can we do that without getting draconian? It's about billions tested and millions in treatment. Public health must itself be human rights compliant. It's not enough on its own, and it won't work otherwise. Informed consent is not just a nice-sounding principle. It's about treatment literacy and effective programming, and we learned that this week. But make no mistake, human rights abuse, even if effective towards a public health goal, is not acceptable. On this, I'd just like to return to criminalisation again. Sorry, I've gone a slide past. I didn't realise I'd done that. On this, I'd like to return to criminalisation very briefly. So long as we criminalise certain groups and push them from services, which can act as excellent data collection mechanisms, we'll never get a proper picture of the epidemic. And I'd like to reiterate what was said before. Please do read the Lancet special edition for this conference. It's a great example of the nexus between science and human rights. Right, sorry, and this the slide I already showed you. AIDS is not in recession. This was a banner, I believe, at ACT UP, maybe, at their stand in the Global Village. We have to remember that the progressive realization of human rights requires the maximum extent of available resources, and that itself is a legal obligation. This includes times of austerity, it includes developing countries, and it includes international cooperation too. Innovative financing mechanisms such as the Robin Hood tax may themselves be engines for the progressive realization of rights. But all the while, let's remember that funding must be delivered in a non-discriminatory way. This week we were asked what it would cost to address HIV among women, and we don't know. We learned about the complexities of disability and AIDS, women who use drugs, women who are sex workers, women who are migrants, women who are all three. Non-discrimination includes finding ways to assist those in need of special attention and to ensure their rights are guaranteed. But where will we get the money? To begin with, let's at least redirect funding from failed policies. That's pretty simple. Anyone who is in the drug policy zone, I'm sure they saw the amazing ticker, counting up the dollars spent on the global war on drugs during the conference. There too is our AIDS money being used to fund policies that fuel the epidemic. Microbicides might not seem like a human rights track issue, but everybody has the right to benefit from scientific progress and its applications. This came to my mind during the microbicide session, and I raise it here because the same threats we experience with generic ARVs, we must now expect and start to address if people are to benefit from any such discoveries. Harm reduction works to reduce the spread of HIV, and we know this for a long time. Bill Clinton knows this, and he said it in his speech. Barack Obama knows this, and PEPFAR guidelines now recognize this. But harm reduction must benefit young people and women, too. Here I'd like to recognize the work of YouthRise, the international network of people who use drugs, and the Eurasian Harm Reduction Network, because solutions are hard to find, but they will not come from governments. They're going to come from groups like these. Of course I'm going to raise this. The scientists are increasingly coming to human rights conclusions based on their research, and that's what the Vienna Declaration is all about. We know from decades of evidence that unless we address our international and national drug laws and policies, we're never, ever going to beat this epidemic. Please, if you've not yet done so, read the declaration. If you agree with it, sign it, pass it on. And I'm assured by the organizers that this process will continue after this conference. So what do we want to see in 2 years? You'll have your own ideas, and I'll miss people's priorities, but here's some of my ideas. We should be seeing more funding for rights-based programming, because it's required by international law, and because it works, it's all that will work. Hopefully Austria will have drawn inspiration from the conference and begun to contribute to the Global Fund. I've already touched on the next 2 points, I won't reiterate, but I understand there were some problems with people getting to this conference, and I hope that we can start planning now to predict barriers to attendance and deal with them in advance. And of course, by Washington, Maxim Popov in Uzbekistan and the Alay brothers in Iran should have been long enjoying their freedom, and Ilya Podolyan should have been exonerated in the Ukraine. I wonder, though, will we see a lifting of Russia's ban on OST? I doubt it. And I wonder, will we see a reduction in deaths from TB? I hope so. So during the conference, to remind us what went on while we're in this cocoon, $2 billion were spent on the war on drugs. 3,000 people in the region that is the focus of the conference, Eastern Europe and Central Asia, contracted HIV. And meanwhile, Russia reasserted its plans to do absolutely nothing about that, while preparations were being made for a Russian government official to take the reins of the lead agency on the issue at the UN. But Namibia announced removal of travel restrictions, and Argentina legalized same-sex marriage. There are benefits. I have 5 seconds and I'm going to say this. Rights Here, Right Now has been the theme of the conference, but to use a rather obscure musical reference, this is not here. This is not now. The fight is at the international, national and community levels where you all work. So from the Track F team, safe travels and good luck.
Thank you very much. Track F was innovative in its introduction, and its report showed us how important it is. It's with great pleasure that I introduce the rapporteur on our Leadership and Accountability Programme, Nathan Ford.
Thank you very much, and you'll be delighted to know that due to the cross-cutting nature of this conference, many of my slides have already been covered by others, so I'll be able to go a little quicker than I'd thought. Now, leadership and accountability it's the first time that this conference has included accountability in the leadership track, and I think the conference generally has done a very good job of providing platforms not only for leaders to get up and make statements, but also for them to be held account by mixing political leaders with civil society groups, by mixing people, marginalised groups, with the policymakers that make them marginalised. And when you do that, it creates an opportunity for leaders to apologise, to make commitments, and hopefully to say things for which, as they move forward, will be held to account. Now, one good example of that comes from Archbishop Zimbi from Kenya, who at a meeting here in the conference earlier this week said, "We want to apologise for not doing what we should have done and for doing what we should not have done." And in other parts of the conference, religious leaders have made it clear that HIV is a virus and not a moral issue, and when morality gets in the way of policy, the results too often are morbidity and mortality, and I think that's an echo across many of the human rights issues that have already been summarised for IDUs and many other groups. Now, People living with HIV/AIDS, the activists, have certainly continued to demand better leadership and accountability. There has been some criticism about the demonstrations, but it's something that absolutely needs to continue to have a place at these conferences. And there has been a sense of a renewed activism, particularly around human rights and issues of access to medicines at this very difficult time where the amount of funding for HIV is slowly drying up. But it's important to note some other presentations that were made at this conference showing that civil society and activist groups are not just about making noises and demanding that other people are held accountable, but working very, very hard to develop accountability mechanisms that work. Here's one example from Belarus, the implementation of the stigma index, and also holding themselves to better account. This was an example of an accountability framework for those civil society representatives of international fora like the Global Fund, developing a framework so they may be better accountable to their own communities in those platforms and not just representing their own ideas. We've heard a lot about the Vienna Declaration, and I just wanted to applaud the IAS for showing very, very strong leadership on this issue. But it has also been pointed out that while some 12,000 plus signatories have been gathered during this conference, there are 19,000 of us here, and so some 7,000 delegates have not signed up yet. And it's not just about the participants at this conference either. The Vienna Declaration is very much a living document, and we want as many signatories as we can moving through to the 2012 conference, which will take place at one of the major centres of the war on drugs. Now, the point has already been made that improving the situation is not so much one of evidence anymore, because for many of the greatest improvements we could make, the evidence is now in. The Lancet series has demonstrated elegantly a number of policies that work. It's a matter of showing the political will and so for leadership and accountability to kick in and address those countries, those programs, those policies that fail to take account of the latest evidence. Now, rights here, right now, it's just been covered by the previous participant that this was the slogan of the conference. We have seen some shocking examples of continuing abuses of human rights that that were presented at the conference in Namibia and other parts of southern Africa. The forcible and coercive sterilization continues at some public hospitals, often as a condition of delivery or abortion services. But we have also seen some positive examples from leaders around the world where through embracing human rights positive frameworks, they have managed to have a substantial impact on the HIV epidemic. And the example from New Zealand, where police were previously targeting sex workers using condoms as evidence, a possession of condoms as evidence of being a sex worker and arresting them, has recently changed. And through a human rights-based framework, legislation was passed to decriminalise sex work, and it removed a significant barrier to HIV prevention, not just among sex workers, but within the general population. So, a lot of talk at this conference, particularly in the leadership and accountability track, about the future of universal access. As we know, universal access was a target for this year. We're not going to make it. There have been some calls for a new target to be set of 15 by 15, taking into recognition the fact that the Millennium Development Goals ought to have been met by 2015, and we will fail completely to address many of the important, if not all of the important, Millennium Development Goals unless we continue to scale up efforts in the fight against HIV/AIDS. However, it is important to note when we talk about targets that we need meaningful targets, and this presentation shows very nicely the disparity between general universal access targets, for which over 83 countries, I'll just look at where the mouse is, had implemented those at the national level, and targets specifically for high-risk groups and marginalised groups. So only 13 countries had established national-level targets for MSM, and only 15 countries had established national-level targets for IDU. So as we recognise that targets are important, the 15 by 15 has to be much more nuanced than a simple global target, because you can certainly reach universal access targets without doing anything for those most at risk. And here's an example of why it's important to address targets in a more meaningful way, because we know very, very well that where we do have data, we see the striking disparity between the HIV prevalence in the general population and those among high-risk groups. However, the vast majority of countries do not report that data, and some hundred or so countries have absolutely no data available whatsoever to report on HIV prevalence among MSM. Now, the UN, UNAIDS and the WHO, I believe, should be strongly applauded for showing their leadership in embracing the latest science to inform their guidelines for antiretroviral therapy in resource-limited settings. Peter Mugenyi from Uganda made the very important point that this is science that is not just for the developed world, and there is another science for the developing world, but as the evidence comes through for earlier initiation, for more effectiveness and better tolerability of newer drugs, that those tools, every effort is made to make those tools available to everyone who needs them. The problem, of course, is that we are being told at this conference that we're running out of money in the response to HIV, and donors, most of the major donors have been here making a very, very strong statement that we need to find much, much greater efficiencies in the AIDS response. Now, some examples of efficiencies have been given by some of the other rapporteurs. I just want to dwell on one very important one in which civil society groups have been holding the donors up to account, and that's the perpetuation of the international intellectual property laws that restrict access to affordable medicines. And it's quite a powerful statement that was made in one of the sessions here, that it's very, very rich for major donors to go around telling the developing world to find greater efficiencies when those very same governments are perpetuating policies that drive up the price of drugs to an unaffordable level. And there are policies, as well as stopping the perpetuation of the ever-increasing monopolization of medicines through pushing for tighter patent protection. There are also very clearly policies that exist right now that could be implemented to overcome barriers to intellectual property where they exist. And it's also beholden on the countries most effective to follow the lead of those countries like Thailand and Brazil in making a maximum effort to use those safeguards and contribute. And as previous rapporteurs have made the point, I'm sorry, there's a misquote here, it's not just about antiretroviral drugs either. As one person said in this conference, HIV-positive people are now surviving with an incurable disease but dying from a curable disease in the case of hepatitis C because the price of treatment is in excess of some $20,000. Now, finally, on to the issue of funding. There have been, it's been a theme at pretty much every day at this conference and in many large and smaller sessions. But even with efficiencies, the point has been made that we frankly just need more money. The evidence is clear. It was shown by previous rapporteurs that we are in a situation of flatlining, and despite the rhetoric of some of the funders here this week at the conference, it's very, very clear that we're going into a scenario where the amount of money is decreasing as the epidemic continues to increase. This has already been covered. We have a number of mechanisms that show efficiency, that can be improved in their efficiency, both in the disbursement of money. We have examples of where we can be more efficient in the implementation, in the technical assistance provided by the multilateral institutes, and we have some innovative finance mechanisms that really need to be embraced to ensure that more money flows through the pipeline. And I want to stop here by making the point that has been made by very many people in this conference, including some of the major donors, including the Global Fund, that the issue of lack of money is not one of pure lack of money per se, but a lack of political choice in where to spend it. Thank you very much.
Nathan, thank you. Very, very much indeed. And one of my take-home messages from this conference is that it's not that AIDS is overfunded, it is that public health is underfunded. Our next speaker is reporting from the community program, Dr. Nikhil Antony. Over to you.
Good afternoon. Over the past week, I've had the distinct privilege of working with an exceptional team of professionals from the field, where we collected and reported valuable information for people providing community-level services across the world. It was a wonderful experience being a frontline provider and having access to the type of information and results that the field has brought. The community program vision was that AIDS 2010 would create the space for community empowerment and engagement and will be an opportunity for people living with HIV and affected communities to reclaim ownership of the HIV/AIDS agenda at all levels. The inclusion of positive health, dignity, and HIV prevention is critical to increasing effectiveness and sustaining national strategies and local programs. I can attest that this space was indeed created over this past week. So, how did we get that? How did that happen? The community program's approach was to link communities with evidence-based science, providing communities with skills-building development workshops, and the ABCC directory, accessing the top scientists, building networks with leading experts, and connecting capacity of collective learning into action. In working with community-based organizations for the past 20 years, when trying to be of assistance, the response or the request is to give us information that we can use. And so as my colleagues have here today said, we would like to put into action what we've learned here. As such, I'll be presenting some cross-cutting key findings gleaned from the numerous abstract-driven sessions, workshops, and poster presentations. Since we understand that research informs, here's what we've learned. In living with HIV, in that area, that we suggest collaborative multi-agency work is needed. We need to link people living with HIV and aging networks with comprehensive and appropriate medical, social, and psychological care. Peer-driven support and education is considered essential, as we need to make people aware of self-management strategies that can mitigate some of the harms caused by both aging and HIV. Over the next few years, it is anticipated that people living with HIV and AIDS will be over 50. Actually, in the U.S., as I understand it, a large percentage will be living over 50. Under human rights, what we can do. We can create a framework advancing the integration of human rights protections into the global AIDS response. It should be a unifying call to action for the global community. A legislative policy and practice agenda should be developed targeting eliminating inhumane conditions and must protect the rights of all people. My colleagues before have given you lots of ways to make that happen. Networking. This whole conference has been an opportunity to network, but we're suggesting that at the community level, we need to network more effectively to create effective treatment, care, and prevention, which will require the collaboration between all stakeholders. And it also enables the leveraging of resources, information, and advocacy. We've learned from our funders that they're even interested in funding community strengthening. We also suggest that we consider building community coalitions. From a funding perspective, civil society organizations should see themselves as partners with governments who are mutually accountable to a transparent system. We talk about accountability here, but we as community-level organizations are also accountable. We can become involved through citizen report cards and social auditing. Organizations must also engage with a range of people from key government agencies. Data rules in this world, and we understand we need to look at budget analysis, research offices, treasuries, donors, analyze reports on policies, performance, budget expenditures, conduct multiple assessments, and participate in the budgeting process. We have to be at the table to make a difference. From an advocacy standpoint, there are key elements to all successful activism have been effective here this week. But we need to make sure it includes factual information, a clear message, a targeted audience, and expected outcomes. for people living with HIV over the age of 50 being represented a sizable part of the community within the next few years, we should also plan for an agenda of improving the support and visibility of older adults with HIV. Many of our slides don't show that aging population. For advocacy, there's some agenda items that we pulled from our team from an advocacy standpoint. We've realized through the research, or lack of research, that there's an increased need for options and access to new interventions and models for care for women. Various structural factors such as gender inequalities, economic security, and public policy continue to negatively impact women-centered prevention efforts. We also learned that homosexual behavior and individual homosexual orientation and identity are being legally criminalized and marginalized by cultural customs in countries around the world, exacerbating the social marginalization and stigma associated with HIV prevention targeted to MSMs and transgenders. Advocacy to eliminate these practices must be a call to action for all nations. Now, to move on to collaborating with our governments. They're not just our funders, they're our partners. Communities can provide evidence to policymakers at the highest levels through formal and informal communication that punitive legislation is counterproductive to their goals and creating healthy societies. We have immediate access to that information, and even if needed, sound bites that can come to your front door and learn what the impact is. Community strengthening. Outreach to our faith leaders should occur earlier than later. So we're suggesting that they reach out to them in seminaries, in schools, where they can be taught about HIV and AIDS before they are released into the world to make a difference. The message that we're hoping to put is love, respect, and compassion in response to HIV. And from a community leadership standpoint, we should be developing leadership skills and tools to influence research, engage with policy development, and interact successfully with the media and key decision makers. We've learned a lot from the research community, and I'd like to share some real life lessons from the field that will benefit our community-based organizations. In rural Malawi, tax shifting in resource-limited setting has proven improved access to HIV and care and testing. Task shifting, which we thought was really interesting, is actually looking at the entire routine, daily routine that it takes to perform clinical work, and shifting the heavy clinical work and the counseling and clerical work to different bodies so that it increases the access to care. In Mozambique, self-management and the development of expert patients to deliver ARVs to local self-formed groups improves retention and adherence and separate medical care and HIV prevention. Within each of the local groups of 6 stable patients, one person travels to pick up the medication each month and is trained to go to work with the group on adherence issues and reporting of ill health, which would then result in a clinical visit. There are currently 291 groups with 1,384 members who share money and resources to send the group representative. Not only did the initiative work and massively reduce the workload of healthcare providers, but patients also reported decreased stigma due to having a built-in support group and not having to disclose their status by default when traveling to a clinic on a regular basis. In Western Kenya, low-risk express care demonstrated no opportunistic infections or history of adherence problems from switching patients who were stable on ART with CD4 counts below 200 from doctor to nurse-led care in 2 out of every 3 visits. So our team came up with a few thoughts of what we could do from a community standpoint and what we'd like to offer to this community. Go to our list, there's something that's come across from our panel here today, that we need to move from bench to bedside or from papers to people, and the community-based organizations are a great place to do that. These communities can also be afforded an opportunity to continue this dialogue that we've had here over the week through social networks to maintain a link. We can facilitate the application of evidence-based models. We can use listservs, webinars, Skype. I'm still learning about some of those. Valuable lessons can also be learned from the creation of global community connections and peer mentoring for professional development. I think community-based organizations should consider some linkage with academic institutions, be them local or abroad, to help create an environment of connection. Universal advocacy on human rights issues must target marginalized communities so the voice of the world's humanity is linked together. We've heard so many distressing stories about migrants, sex workers, ex-offenders, and IDUs that we have to band our voices together as a community and make it a global community to make a difference. People living with HIV must also have meaningful involvement with all the areas of the process throughout the entire life of the policy advocacy or project implementation. Their participation makes a significant difference. And we look forward to being your partners as you move from your research to the field. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much indeed. And now we turn to our rapporteur from the Global Village, Dr. Klein Murdoch. Thank you, and the panel is yours.
Thank you very much. To start with, buon tardi, please God. I would like to thank my most professional team, Kate Hawkins and Dudley Fernandez. This is the first time that there is actually a rapporteur team of the activities of the Global Village to actually stress the linkage between what happens in the Global Village and the whole of this conference. Arriving at the Global Village on the first day, we felt like Dorothy after finally having reached Oz, a wonderful, magical world of inspiration and activism. Only Dorothy had a whole series of books and movies to tell a story. We now have only 7 minutes and good shoes. So here goes. Global Village, that vibrating, multi-everything explosion of community activism and bodies of knowledge, or just bodies, at the opening was hosted by the ravishing Lakshmi, the Asia-Pacific Network of Sex Workers' Bad Girl Ambassador. Now, if there is anything, yes, applause is well-deserved. If there is anything the organizers could have done to enhance the visibility of the Hijra, the world trans community, it was staging Lakshmi as mistress of ceremonies. But then there are many more communities striving for attention and visibilities in the main and side alleys of this village, some more, some less successful. Another fabulous idea was to dedicate a day and lots of events to our disabled brothers and sisters, the visually impaired and deaf people. Sitting down in their zone, we heard a South African brother, for instance, explain how they had to invent new signs for, among others, STDs, and how in Africa myths play a huge role in the universe of the deaf. Decodifying those myths become a huge endeavor, which community activists all over the continent are tackling. And then, in the middle of this exotic mix of noises, of course, the complaints. Too noisy, too hot, too cold, not catering to the globality of our village. And then, of course, maybe too many tourists and travelers, the need for much more activists. But it's also a beautiful place. Almost in the center of the Global Village, there is the Wish Tree, a project of the AIDS Federation East-West. Passers-by have put up their wishes for an answer to the growing epidemic of Eastern Europe and Central Asia. Wishes for today, but among them, there are also wishes for things to be accomplished before the next IAC in Washington, D.C. in 2012. The bulk of the wishes will be handed, 6,000 by now, to the UNAIDS Secretary General. Wishes can be read, of course, online, and please feel invited to do so. And then a giant ice man, a human-like statue carved from ice, brought to the central performance area. A group of representatives from Eastern Europe and Central Asia explained that as much as the already melting ice man stands as a metaphor for their lives that are melting away fast in the epidemic, there is the anticipation of a future statue which won't melt to be erected at the next IAC when hopefully the fast spread of the epidemic in their eastern lands will be halted. And people find synergies between communities. Like in the women's leadership sessions, people were talking sex workers' rights. And the harm reduction advocates learning from the models and strategies of the gay rights advocates. LGBTI participants learning about each other, and transgender activists finding themselves at a convergent point of many, actually all, other communities. The networking zone hosted many sessions that were not on the official conference agenda, but which were hugely valuable. It's heartening to see how the harm reduction approach and its language have now become mainstream, not only among policymakers, but also among activists. But there is still a long way to go. And then there was the cacophonous but ever-exciting sounds of demonstrations and processions of the disenchanted, but rightfully so. From financial mismanagement in Tanzania to housing rights to treatment access and decriminalization of homosexuality in the Caribbean and Africa, among others. And of course, the big human rights march, which made our presence clear not only to Vienna, not only to Austria, but to the world. And then, more complaints. The need for access for all, the need for scientists to engage with communities, and the importance of communication for accountability. And of course, the separation, not only the virtual separation, but even the geographical separation. It's almost about the yin and the yang of this building. Plenary, global village at the other side. We were blessed to have some high-profile visitors, like Princess Mette Marit of Norway in the Youth Pavilion. In the same Youth Pavilion, we learned about how local celebrities and countries, by acting as role models, actively engage youth and inspire them to participate in peer-to-peer edutainment activities. The Global Village is absolutely the most glamorous part of the conference, and certainly also the most sexy, actually shown by these Brazilian sex workers' fashion show. But we worry that it is still too separate from the rest of activities, both in content as in actual location. And we hope that in Washington, D.C., 2 years from now, steps will be taken to bring the two more together. So among the free hugs and the free kisses, more communion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for that report from the Global Village. Emily Carson is going to report from the youth program. Emily, you need to understand that your being at the end of the program is not an indication of the importance, because youth are so important. But we looked at a Kaplan-Meier curve and decided you were most likely to still be alive at this point.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for staying around. Okay, that's good. First and foremost, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the International AIDS Conference for including a youth voice in this forum. This is my second International AIDS Conference, and if in 2008 you told me I'd be standing here right now, I would have laughed in your face. I honestly never thought I would be reporting on the situation regarding youth, but today I represent my peers, those who are fortunate enough to be able to attend this conference and those who weren't. There are 1,500 youth in attendance of this conference. We are here, and young people need to get their voices meaningfully included, especially those from key affected populations. I think this conference has been a really big step in that direction. We talk a lot about the power of the youth voice. I wish you all could have experienced the raw power of the pre-conference last week. The electricity and collaboration of youth, the youth pre-conference was intense. 300 young people from all around the world were led by the amazing Vienna Youth Force team to engage in 3 days of networking, skill sharing, and co-education. Youth participated in this conference, represented more than 95 countries, and represented a vast myriad of different organizations and brought many different perspectives and specializations to the delegates. We've made tremendous strides, and from the data that was released last week, we know that HIV prevalence and trends in 16 countries have shown a decline among young people 15 to 24 years old. Young people's involvement and leadership was key in making this reality. This is a fantastic feat, and we are nowhere near halting the transmission in youth. We must work harder and push more forcefully until we reach the goal of no new infections. We can do this. We can make this happen in our lifetime. We have many amazing partners that have come up and given commitment to youth. The Global Fund and UNAIDS have both invested to involving more youth and more young people in substantial and concrete ways, and not just mere tokenism. We have developed strong allies, and Michelle Sidibe, the Executive Director of UNAIDS, and Her Royal Highness, the Crown Princess of Norway, both who spent many days this past week engaging with young people in meetings and events, and we urge them to please make it happen. I'm happy to see that established leaders have stepped up and taken notice of the power behind the youth voice. We're willing to invest our time, our skills, and our loyalty if you're willing to support us logistically, intellectually, and monetarily. We have made this clear through the astounding amounts of applications to the e-course and grants from both of the organizations I work for, along with the amount of applications that came in for the participation in the youth pre-conference and the main conference. For the first time, we're focusing on subjects like harm reduction, injected drug use, and sex work. I believe by opening these conversations, we drove the conference to a more political and direct action-oriented environment. Youth were at the forefront of these movements and highly visible during the protests that happened during this past week. We called for transparency and accountability in funding for AIDS. We protested against international governments, much like my own of Canada, when they continually refused to meet the constituents' needs in regards to the full spectrum of harm reduction. We also have advocated for the integration of sex workers into the consciousness of this conference as a whole. I still don't think we've touched even the surface of these conversations. Article number 34 of the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of the Child says state parties undertake to protect the child in all forms of sexual exploitation and sexual abuse. This restricted the conversation to only include sex workers over the age of majority. But what about the complexities of the situation for young sex workers? The criminalization of sex work only further stigmatizes and endangers sex workers and young sex workers and heightens the risk of the entire community. In addition, the criminalization of drug use and possession and the reluctance to incorporate harm reduction measures like needle exchange and syringe exchange, safe injection and inhalation sites, education about drugs, and only further drives the HIV pandemic in all communities. Punitive laws need to be repealed and replaced. There needs to be effective measures to reach out, eradicate, and provide health and safety within the IDU and sex work communities. Lastly, we cannot lose sight of the fact that the pandemic is still prominent in the LGBTQ community, and further work to decriminalize same-sex relationships, reduce homophobia, stigma, and discrimination is crucial in continuing to make progress in response of HIV. We also need to fight complacency within the young LGBT community in regards to HIV and AIDS. Another main issue that throughout the conference was surrounding funding. The economic turbulence has driven up the government deficits in too many countries. And they've responded by reducing their investments in global health. Youth initiatives need to be funded so we can go out and do what we're good at. We need to advocate and educate our own communities. The international community as a whole needs to fund the unfundable projects and subject matters. They need to redirect funding to core areas and capacity building so we can continue to have sustainable youth organizations, so we can train to support the next generation of youth leaders. We need to work within our communities to understand their needs and to apply lessons learned to advocate for better, effective, evidence-based policies and programs, and to ensure our change in the world in the response to HIV and AIDS. These ideas also need to drive from the community of young people living with HIV and young key populations. We also need to strive and encourage strong, positive youth to come out and come forward to help us refocus the target of our activism. I'd like to thank all the members of the Vietnam Youth Force and the efforts to bring the youth voice, experience, and expertise to the forefront of AIDS 2010, as well as my colleagues and mentors at the Global Youth Coalition on HIV and AIDS and the HIV Young Leaders Fund. The entire youth force would like to thank the leaders of this conference that took up the complex and controversial issues surrounding HIV and AIDS, and I would like to invite you all to read the entire youth team's summaries of the AIDS 2010 conference on the website. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the rapporteur session. I want to do one thing that I never got to do in South Africa, which is look on the screen and wave at myself. But I also want to thank you on behalf of the IAS, on behalf of the conference organizers, a wonderful panel I've had up here. It's been a real pleasure to chair it, and most of all, to thank you, the participants. Let's break before the closing ceremony, and let's give ourselves all a big hand. Thank you.